Have one case on our docket this morning, Michael Webb versus Alpha Omega Services and Frank P. Keller. We have another case on our 10:30 docket, but we were ready to get started at 9, and Justice Pittman has graciously agreed to serve on your panel this morning, so we appreciate that very much. Our third panel member is not able to arrive timely, so we are beginning. If counsel are ready, we will have the clerk call the case. Ready to proceed? All right.
Yes, Your Honor.
The court will now call Michael Webb versus Alpha and Omega Services. It may please the court, Mr. Michael Henry to argue for the appellant, and Ms. Paul Guest to argue for the appellant.
Mr. Minton, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please this honorable court. Good morning. I hope nothing untoward has happened to Justice Myers. But we're here this morning.
Here we go.
Thank you, Judge Pittman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sorry, counsel. Apologize, judges.
Quite all right, Your Honor.
Glad you made it.
Me too.
Obviously, we're here to talk about everybody's favorite statute, the Texas Citizens Participation Act. I'd like to begin my argument by pointing out that any insufficiencies in my argument or in my briefing are probably the result, as the court may or may not be aware, I'm primarily an insurance defense attorney, which is kind of how I got into this. And this is a bit of a whole new world for me, both in terms of the evidentiary standard of review and the nature of the claims themselves. So I'll try to muddle through it, but any shortcomings are not, they're not Rod Tanner's fault, they would be mine. As the court knows, this is a case involving questions of timing of two lawsuits that were very closely filed together. One is the lawsuit that was filed by Michael Webb in June regarding a class action for labor code violations, both common law and state and federal statutory claims in California. A&O, Alpha and Omega, and Frank Keller essentially run a horseback security agency. And they filed a lawsuit against Mr. Webb then on, I believe, July 29. So we have two lawsuits that are very closely timed, one filed in California, one filed in A&O's backyard. I do not believe, during the pendency of this appeal, the Supreme Court handed down ExxonMobil versus Coleman. And I think in light of that case, I do not believe that it can be seriously argued by the appellees that these claims do not fall within the ambit of the act. These were communications about matters of concern. They were not made in a public governmental forum. For the most part, they weren't made over on the internet or on Twitter, although one could argue Twitter is becoming a governmental forum. These were matters of public concern that were discussed among individuals who were all employed, and when I say employed, not as employees, but independent contractors working for a common employer slash master, whatever you would like to call it. To the extent there was any question that these types of communications among people in a common workplace or with a common employment purpose do not fall within the act, that was soundly put to bed by ExxonMobil. As far as the breach of contract claims are concerned, if you look at page 14 of my brief, if you look at the language that's there, they say that my client breached his contract because of what he said, because of these complaints that were made to the other employees that Mr. Webb thought that because of licensing issues that the company was operating illegally in the state of Florida. By the time you get to the end of the allegation, it is then and only then that they discuss the non-solicitation provision in the contract. Now, we then get, I think stage one of the analysis, as I understand it, is a gimme. Stage two is, did they prove by clear and specific evidence a prima facie case for each element of their claims? Can I tell you what clear and specific evidence is? No, I'm not really sure if I understand. I understand what clear means. I understand what specific means. But I don't understand. I honestly don't understand. The only thing I can draw from the Supreme Court and the other courts of appeals that have ruled on this issue is if they affirm the denial of the motion to dismiss, then the evidence must have been clear and specific. I can't give you any brighter line test than that. One thing I do wish to point out, with regard to the defamation claim, there has to be publication of a defamatory statement. The defamatory statements in this case were Webb saying, I think we're operating illegally. Again, I'm paraphrasing here. We're going to get in trouble. We're all going to get arrested. Frank Keller got arrested. One of the things that I missed in my initial briefing, but I do not think is waived, and I'll come to that in a second, is the plaintiffs, A&O claims that this was defamatory per se. And as the court is aware, if a statement is defamatory per se, then damages are presumed. That's all well and good as far as it goes. First of all, in this day and age, I think that the idea of defamation per se is probably going to go the way of trespass on the case. It's just an archaic term. But...
it's a pretty simple term, isn't it? It means you accuse somebody of a crime.
It means you accuse somebody, yes, that is correct. But people, you know, accuse others of crimes all the time. And while you are correct, Justice Gabriel, that is the law. I think my own personal opinion, for whatever it's worth, is I think that may be, especially in light of the TCPA, may be undergoing a sea change. But let me tell you why I believe that the defamation per se issue is important. I did some further reading as I was preparing last night. The Supreme Court of Texas has held that in a defamation per se case, damages are presumed, but the damages are presumed are nominal damages. That case is Salinas versus Salinas, 365 Southwest 3rd, 318. And in that case, the Supreme Court made reference, they relied on an authority from this court, Denton Publishing Company versus Boyd, 448 Southwest 2nd, 145. And they said, okay, we presume you were damaged. You get a dollar. Now, did I raise this issue in my brief? No, I did not. I concede that. However, because of the nature of the de novo review in this case, you've got to look at this thing just like the trial court, soup to nuts. If all that they're claiming is nominal damages, then for the same reasons as a breach of contract case, I say that they have not proved all the elements of the defamation claim. Again, that wasn't in the briefing, but because you have to look at everything all over again.
Well, they don't have to marshal their proof at this stage of the proceeding and prove an amount of damages. And defamation per se gets you past the damages issue on the clear and specific evidence. Do you have any case law that supports anything different than that?
I do not, Your Honor. Not at this time. If I come across that, I will supplement it. But when you say it gets you past, what does it get you? It gets you to nominal damages, which, as the Supreme Court has said, nominal damages are not damages. They're a substitute for damages. I would urge the court not to place the price of $1 on somebody's ability to exercise their First Amendment rights, because that's essentially what you're talking about.
Well, I don't think they're claiming $1 in damages, but again, I go back to the case law says that on a motion to dismiss under the TCPA, if it's defamation per se, that's damages are presumed. Not just $1, damages are presumed.
Your Honor, I would simply ask that the court, if you would look at the Salinas case, I was kind of surprised when I came across it last night about 9:30. If you would look at the Salinas case, that's probably the best argument I can make on that issue. And it's the case, as far as I can tell, that best addresses the issue. And that goes back to the breach of contract claim also with regard to nominal damages. First of all, we have to have a breach, and I don't believe that a breach has been shown in this case. The solicitation agreement refers to solicitation of employees. Webb's an independent contractor. It's an independent contractor and agreement. They're all independent contractors. It's not like they have 100 personnel and one of them's an independent contractor and 99 are regular W-2 employees. These are all independent contractors. And if Michael Webb solicited them to leave their job and join, and by the way, when you say leave their job, these are not full-time jobs. These are basically weekend gigs. When he encouraged them to join his class action suit, at that point in time, he's encouraging independent contractors, not employees. It's their contract. They wrote it.
In your argument, where you are arguing that a common interest privilege applies in this case, your argument says that these statements are privileged because they were circulated among employees. That was your word, employees.
Yes, Your Honor.
You can't have it one way to support what you're saying and another way to refute what they're saying. So which is it? Is it employees or is it independent contractors, which may then, you know, diffuse your whole common interest privilege argument?
With regard to your statement that I can't have it both ways, you're right, but I can try. But with regard to that, I think that when you're talking about a common interest between among members of a group, as long as they have a common interest, and that is, you know, the ability to do their job as a part of a regulated industry, and the fact that they do have some sort of bond, perhaps not as close as an employee agreement. No, I concede, again, that's one of the weaknesses in my briefing that I told the court at the beginning about. But these people are independent contractors. They're not W-2 employees. Also, with regard to the damages, the court has to take a look at the fact that many of these statements about damages are nothing more than conclusory statements. I had to spend a lot of time talking to people. I had to deal with morale issues. None of that is translated over into quantifiable damages, which is what they would be required to do in front of a jury. I agree that they don't have to marshal their evidence, but I disagree that means that they can just simply mail it in and just come up with fluff and stick it in an affidavit and avoid dismissal of their claims. As far as the constitutionality issue, I think that, first of all, I want to point out, they never asked for a jury trial. Nobody asked for a jury trial at the time this was heard. They still could have, but they didn't. And, you know, this court and any other court has to inquire whether there was jurisdiction and whether there was ripeness as an element of subject matter jurisdiction. Sure, they still could have, but they didn't. And you can only go on the record that was before the trial court. Also, this wasn't an issue they raised. The trial court raised it sua sponte, which is I'm not sure if that's anything. I'm not sure if that was appropriate for the trial court. But the only
Did you object to it at the time the trial court did it? Or did Mr. Tanner object to it at the time the trial court did it?
I don't believe Mr. Tanner. I believe Mr. Tanner followed the court's instructions and provided additional briefing. but it was not raised by the other side. The only constitutional issue you have before you is the, and I'm watching the light, is the open courts provision. And look, if we can have a medical malpractice screening system like the one that we currently have in place, and it's constitutional, I don't see how this can be unconstitutional under the open records provision. Not open records, under the TCPA. For those reasons, Your Honor, again, if I did not answer your questions, I would refer you back to the briefing in this case, which I think was pretty well done by both sides. My hat's off to Mr. Getz. But we believe that the court was in error when he refused to dismiss the case. We ask that this case be reversed and sent back to the trial court for a hearing on attorney's fees. And I'll return the remainder of my time to the court.
Thank you, Mr. Minton.
May it please this honorable court, good morning. My name is Paul Getz, and I represent the plaintiffs in the underlying lawsuit and the appellees in this court, Alpha and Omega Services, Inc., and its president and CEO, Frank Keller. And I wanted to discuss some points that Mr. Minton brought up and some additional matters that we have brought up and are set forth in our briefing. First, there's an issue with regard to the standard of review and the contention being that the de novo standard includes a de novo review of the facts. I don't dispute that. But we argue that the facts should be reviewed in light most favorable to the non-movement, and in this case, the appellees.
What case provides that?
And there may be a split, Your Honor, but there are two cases that give deference to a trial court's factual findings.
But how can we give deference to factual findings when the standard of review is de novo?
Well, there are two cases that we can cite that provide for that. In other words, it's in a way I would say it's somewhat deference to the trial court's findings, similar to a situation where you have a motion for summary judgment.
But in a summary judgment, we're just looking to see if there's a genuine issue of material fact. We're not looking to see if there's clear and specific evidence of a particular element.
That's true, Your Honor. However, the reviewing court has to look at the findings in light most favorable to the non-movement
but
in
I'm
summary
asking,
judgment
I'm asking
context.
Just from true in a summary judgment context to see if construed in the light most favorable to the non-movement, a reasonable finder of fact could determine that there was a fact issue. But here we're not looking for fact issues. We're looking to see if there has been clear and specific evidence presented of a specific element. So my question is, why should we review that in the light most favorable to anyone when we're conducting a de novo review and the trial court hasn't usually typically heard witnesses? It's all affidavits and evidence. Why would it make any sense to defer or review anything in the light most favorable to anyone in a de novo review of a anti-SLAPP motion and the evidence presented?
Your Honor, that's a good point. We simply would refer you to a couple of cases.
Perfect.
That indicate that. The first case is Duell, D-E-U-E, LL versus Texas Right to Life Commission, Inc. That's 508 Southwest 3rd, 679, and that's out of Houston. And Newspaper Holdings, Inc. versus Crazy Hotel Assisted Living Limited. Yes, that's the name of the company. 416 Southwest 3rd, 71, again, out of the First District of Houston.
Are those anti-SLAPP cases?
I'm sorry?
Are those TCPA cases, motion to dismiss cases?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Yes, they are. Now, another point that I wanted to bring up, and I want to spend a little time on the constitutional issues that we have raised. The Exxon case that
were,
Mr.
Were Minton, those raised in the trial court? I understand the trial court asked for a briefing on them, but is there any pleading to support that?
Any, well, in
other
the...
Other than the additional briefing?
We did do, both sides did an additional briefing as per the trial court's request on the open court constitutional issue that we raised in our response to the motion to dismiss, and other, my interpretation of the court's request, and other constitutional issues that were all brought out at that hearing. In the plaintiff's petition that was originally filed in the trial court, I don't believe that any constitutional issues were raised. There was absolutely no need for that at that point. It was then in the briefing that took place on the motion to dismiss in the trial court that we raised the constitutional issues. And I would suggest that based upon the questions in the comments of the trial court relating to the constitutional issues, those were understood and inquiry made as to what the basis of those issues were. And since we're talking about that, we believe, and there have been cases that have raised issues of constitutionality with regard to the TCPA, but not with regard to the third step. In that regard, when this statute was enacted back in 2011, the proof was, okay, can the defendant, by a preponderance of the evidence, show that these protected rights are involved? And if it can, then the burden shifts over to the plaintiff or the non-movement to establish clear and specific evidence. In other words, just establish a prima facie case of each and every element of its claim. That's where it stopped. We have no issue with regard to the constitutionality of that. But then in 2013, the statute was amended, and the third element of burden shifting was added to provide that, okay, fine, let's say the plaintiff, the non-movement, does establish a prima facie case, which is not a heightened standard, by the way. It's based on pleadings and affidavits, which as a matter of law would establish an element of a claim or a cause of action without consideration of any controverting or contradictory or rebuttal evidence. We have done that here. Then the third step, which we have an issue about from a constitutional perspective, is that once we've done that, the case really should be over. The motion should be dismissed. But the movement then can have the opportunity to establish by a preponderance of the evidence defenses that would defeat the claim. And that is the very issue that appellees have a problem with here, because it imposes a much greater restriction that is necessary in order to carry out the purpose and intent of this statute. And basically what it creates, and again, this some comments were made by the trial court in this regard, it requires a trial court to summarily dismiss a case without there being an opportunity for full and adequate discovery. It puts a trial court early on in a position of having to determine credibility somehow, some way, and I really don't see how that can be done, by just reviewing the pleadings and the affidavits. There's no cross-examination. There are no depositions allowed. There was not a request made for a jury trial, but basically when you have a motion to dismiss filed in a case like this, in essence, the case is stayed pending briefing by the parties and a determination by the trial court of the motion to dismiss. So our constitutional issues, as briefed out, are that it takes away the right of a party to avail itself of the court. It's the open courts provision, Article 1, I believe, Section 13 of the Constitution. Moreover, it deprives a party of his, her, or its right to a trial by jury, where you have a jury or finder of fact weigh the credibility of all of the evidence that is presented here.
Well, what about truth as a defense? I mean, truth as a defense could be established as a matter of law, couldn't it? I'm just saying hypothetically. I'm not saying in this case.
Well,
hypothetically, truth could be established as a matter of law. My point is that you're saying that this provision violates the open courts?
Yes.
Provision? Okay, so you're trying to make an as-applied challenge, correct?
Yes.
Okay, because on its face, it's not facially unconstitutional, because you could establish a defense. A plaintiff could establish a defense as a matter of law, such as truth or something like that. So it has to be an as-applied challenge.
Well,
here,
truth as a defense negates the defamation claim, but as applied here, we have one affidavit that says that Mr. Webb spread false and knowingly false information about the company. On the other hand, we have Mr. Webb who says that, well, that was just my opinion, and I don't see how you have a fact issue here that can't be resolved by taking this affidavit and then considering this affidavit. There's just no way to do that.
Right. I'm just trying to make the point that your challenge here is an as-applied challenge. Well, that it cannot be a facial challenge, because a facial challenge would have to negate a proper action, a proper application of this provision in all circumstances. And so you're not making a facial challenge, you're making an as-applied challenge. That's the point of my question.
As I understand, Your Honor, your use of the term as-applied, I would have to agree.
Thank you.
And I believe...
Well, I think the constitutional questions are really interesting. I have two other questions to jump back to other issues that I want to get in before your time is out. One is, what's your evidence of damages for your breach of contract claim? And is your only breach of contract claim based upon the non-solicitation, and how do you resolve the employees language in there, other than what you put in your brief that everybody knows employees includes independent contractors?
Yes. The damage aspect of it has not been fully and cannot be fully determined at this early stage of the game. But as evidenced in our briefing and in the affidavits, because of Mr. Webb's attempts to get these other folks, the troopers, as they're referred to leave the company, Frank Keller testified that caused severe internal morale problems within the company, and a lot of time and expense was incurred in having to address that. No damages have been quantified, nor are they required to be quantified under the statute. And I apologize, Judge Gabriel, the second question.
Is your only breach of contract based upon the violation of the non-solicitation agreement?
Yes.
Okay, and the employee's language?
In the independent contractor agreement, and Mr. Webb signed two of them, they're part of the record, he's referred to as a trooper, and he's prohibited from soliciting or attempting to get other employees from leaving the company. There's no evidence, certainly no evidence that has been adduced by the appellant that he didn't attempt to get true employees to leave the company.
But you have to produce the clear and specific evidence to prove the elements of your claim.
Yes.
So where's your clear and specific evidence that he solicited employees?
It is, I believe, set forth in one or more of the affidavits that were attached by some of the Alpha and Omega staff that were attached to our responsive brief at the trial court and constitute part of the record.
Okay. Thank you.
I may, to qualify that, I may be mistaken about that, but it's my understanding. There are, I think, 9 affidavits, and I believe that at least one of them supports that proposition.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Katz.
Thank you very much.
Rebuttal?
Briefly, Your Honor. Justice Walker, I think you hit the nail on the head with regard to the deferential standard of review. This isn't a motion for summary judgment where you send it back to the trial court for a jury trial. This is a motion where you conduct a de novo review, and based on that, making it the law of the case, you send it back down to the trial court for entry of an order granting attorney's fees or awarding attorney's fees and dismissing the case. So, as I said before, it's a soup to nuts review. There is a line of cases that was disapproved by the Supreme Court in the Lipsky case, where courts of appeals, including the Dallas Court of Appeals, in a case that I have seen referred to by this court, the appellant's name, the name of the company was Rehack, R-E-H-A-K. I don't have the specific site, but it talked about clear and specific evidence as evidence unaided by inference. And the Supreme Court came back and they said, no. You can have circumstantial evidence as clear and specific evidence, and all of these Court of Appeals cases that say it's a heightened standard of review, we disapprove of that language. I'm familiar with the Dual case. I don't remember exactly what it says, but I think that that was simply, with regard to A&O, a fortuitous misuse of language to say that you review the light in you review the evidence in a light most favorable to the winner. De novo review, the Supreme Court has said, and the cases are cited in our brief. De novo review means you don't give any deference to what the trial court did. I also want to point out to the court that what makes this case even more difficult than your run-of-the-mill TCPA case, we don't have any findings from the trial court. We asked for them. We didn't get them.
But the findings are so limited under Section 27.007 that it wouldn't really tell you anything. The trial court's not required to say, I think that Step 3 is unconstitutional. He just is required to say the TCPA applies, and that's basically it. It's only findings, not conclusions of law. So it really wouldn't be that helpful, would it?
Well, that's an interesting question, Your Honor, because it says, the statute says for the trial court to make findings. It doesn't differentiate between findings of fact and conclusions of law. And you may be right, but the problem is, did the trial court overrule the motion because he found that the claims didn't fall within the TCPA? Did he overrule the motion because they put on a prima facie case? Did he overrule the motion because part of the statute is unconstitutional? We simply don't know. So,
but that statute doesn't require him to tell you that either, even if he were to comply with the request for findings.
I had, in all candor, I hadn't anticipated that question. So, you know, what I think about the statute might be interesting, but I'm not the one that gets the final word on that issue. But I would simply say this. These are difficult cases. I understand the trial court judge made it abundantly clear he doesn't like this statute. Step three, it's clunky. I think that's the best word to describe it. It's clunky. But the legislature made it clunky, and I think it's up to the legislature to correct it. But I think it is clearly constitutional. If you compare it to the Texas Medical Liability Act, where discovery is frozen, and you have to file, the plaintiff has to file a report establishing merit, I mean, there's no difference.
Under that, you don't have disputed. The trial court's not weighing two sides of the evidence. They're just deciding, does this affidavit meet the standards to go forward? And they're not weighing disputing evidence to that.
That is true, Your Honor. That is true. And that is the closest, but the Medical Liability Act is the closest analogy that I can find. But the open courts provision, there's nothing about the TCPA that says you can't bring a lawsuit. At best, the TCPA says perhaps you need to think twice about it if it's a defamation type of lawsuit. Again, I know a lot of people, as far as I can tell, I can only think of 9 judges in the state of Texas that seem to like the TCPA, and they're all down in Austin. I understand it's not a popular statute. I understand that it has my time is up. I understand that it has draconian effects if I'm right. Nonetheless, it's the law, and you know, whichever way this goes, we're all obligated to follow the statute. We're either subjects of or victims of the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Minton. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your arguments here today and for your briefing. It's been helpful to the court. Your case is submitted, and we will be in recess until our 10 o'clock submission.